my privilege to introduce Mark Wexler. Mark is a professor of business ethics at the Siegel Graduate School of Business at Simon Fraser University, and that's where I met him many years ago when we were both considerably younger, but not as wise as we are today. And Mark is also the president and senior partner of the Perimeter Group of Ethics Consultants. And Mark has been a visiting professor at the University of Michigan, McCary University, McGill, and San Diego State University. His teaching, research, and consulting focus on the acquisitions and or depletion of goodwill or reputation in a highly competitive corporate and professional context. And his published work has appeared in over 90 refereed academic journals and in 8 books. His most recent book, Leadership in Context, The 4 Faces of Capitalism, explains how varying conceptions of the successful leader reveal very different ever-competing values in our moral, economic, political, and creative assessments of the potential of those who are at the top of financial, legal, and educational systems. Dr. Wexler is a 4-time teaching award winner, the holder of numerous grants and scholarships for his research, the author of 7 Best Paper of the Year awards, conferred by editors of scholarly journals. And his recent recognition has included the 2002 AstraZeneca International Ethics Scholar in Residence Award, the 2003 recipient of the Public Intellectual Prize, and the 2004 PricewaterhouseCoopers Leadership and Management Education Award, and the 2005 Honoree of Contemporary's Who's Who of Professionals. And he's working now on a book entitled, Who Are Those Monsters? Understanding Corporate Scandals. So I'm very delighted to introduce Mark Wexler. Here we
go. Thank you. Let me address with you what I would like to speak about after that wonderful introduction by Michael and James. My work that I'm working on at the moment and that I'll speak to you about today, and I'm going to mesh together 2 topics I'm working on. Let me introduce them. One is a book I've just finished, Leadership in Context, which looks at the 4 faces of capitalism. As Michael says, looks at the worldviews and axiomatic assumptions that underline them. In fact, this morning I woke up and I knew I was speaking here. I opened the Vancouver Sun in the business section, B3, and there was an ad, you'll see it today if you're interested, for intercontinental hotels. It's something about we live in a very diverse world. We all know there are many worldviews now, and ours is just a little bit superior, okay? Which is essentially what the book's about. The idea of why a particular worldview thinks it's superior. And which is the essence of public controversy. Public controversy is when many worldviews meet and at least 2 of them claim to be superior. And we're going to find out that this is a very frequent event. In democracy, it's a very important event. The notion of the public, as a business professor, we think of the public as consuming public. In democracy and political science, the public is the source of apparently legitimate license. And as a consequence, public controversy jams leadership, jams it in the sense of confuses it no end, confuses it insofar as we have various versions of leaders, and I'm going to work with you on trying to understand them. But the essence of what I'm going to do in the first part of the discussion, first half hour, is discuss the 4, think of them as 4 garrulous guests at a dining room table. And I'll set up the stage for it. And then we'll introduce several public or controversies, globalization, marijuana legalization or decriminalization, and the management of drugs in the Vancouver East Side. And we'll introduce those as local, controversial, and available rather than the most pressing or important. Now, this is us. This is where we sit. Okay, so just to get a sense, I always do that because it gives the audience a sense that what I'm speaking about addresses them and only them. It's somewhat false, but it's always a good beginning. The model that I would like to begin with are 4 garrulous dining room companions who each have different worldviews, and these worldviews are to be entertained at 3 levels, the psychological level, if you will, of the individuals, the group level, and, if you will, the macro political level. I'm less interested in what level you'd like to work the analysis or the concept of the table at. If we keep it as a table, we'll work it at the micro level. Okay? But if we want to, we could do this with Bush and Bin Laden, okay? If we feel so disposed. Or we could do this with Russia and the Ukraine over oil, if we're interested. Okay. So there's a game element to this because I'm allowing us analytically to shift levels. So get on some interdisciplinary thinking when we do this. Before, I'm basing this on the work of Jeffrey Alexander's reading of Talcott Parsons. And Robert Quinn's treatment of competing values. Parsons, of course, the right after World War II, where the problem is the problem that we're addressing today. Sociologically, the problem today is, why is order so impermanent? Okay, public controversy is the notion that order is impermanent. We keep on, if you will, the public wisdom changes its view as time goes on. It's not a permanent notion. And in so doing, if you at all are interested in queuing off the public, you'll find that to be rational is to be quite like a chameleon on a Persian rug. That as the public changes its views, those who are, quote, seeing the public as rational are frequently chasing these ideas. And of course, if you're a marketer in this room, you understand that immediately. That is, if you queue off the public and you try to satisfy the public, you are, and many politicians nowadays are doing precisely that, you get into a kind of very, very interesting pursuit of what I call the chameleon notion of rationality. I'm not interested in that pursuit at this point, but I'm interested in the notion of there being more than one rational worldview that presents itself. And in postmodernism, we've grown accustomed to this in terms of feminism, environmentalism, patriarchy. All of these, in some senses, complicate our news. If you think about the society 30 years ago, you had an expert. Nowadays, you have a panel. The panel is an attempt to embrace the various worldviews. And if you go home tonight, you're going to see panels. And the reason you're seeing panels, of course, is this notion that there is an impermanent rationality in the public. That and you can even see this in Canada, our West Coast spokesperson is different from our Quebec representative on the panel. So I want to get at that notion of the public being somewhat different. To do that, based upon Parsons' AGIL system, those of you who read his notion of society, and I'm going to take it a little further with Quinn into competing values. At the top we have control, and control here refers both at the microanalytic level, the organizational, and the world to few people making the decisions, a world in which few people make decisions. And we're going to see that some publics enjoy that immensely, especially those that are suffering under tremendous uncertainty. The emergence of demagogues, the emergence of people who are elected time and time again without too much of a contest, Belarus yesterday, are instances of a system that is, the public seems to turn control over to a few. And to do so in some senses, if not willingly, at least sometimes legally and legitimately. Okay. And we're going to find out that we get really upset. We'll find out that most of the people in this room, especially if you come through with a spiritual gloss, are coming from a communitarian worldview. It's very, very difficult to see this control notion up there. Decisions by few. Flexibility, the inclusion of many in the decision making. By the way, some people see that as the public, the inclusion of many in this decision making. A false understanding of the public. Many of the public would rather that you made decisions. This doesn't mean that in some senses we're going to read a morality into that, but we're going to understand that there are various times when you go to an expert precisely to seek out the physician because you'd rather not have your opinion registered overly much in the diagnosis. We could call it knowledge asymmetry, we could call it whatever we want, but you really are saying, tell me about what I should do. Very much up there. I'll tell you what we should do. I want input. By the way, as we move to the bottom, we talk about empowerment in the business school. We talk about the flattening of organizations. We talk about democracy. In sociology, we talk about the democratization of capital. We talk about the ability of individuals at lower levels to possess power. David Mechanic. We should think about our table as on a continuum from control to flexibility. We're going to find out arguments move up and down. We could put control at 10 and flexibility at 0 and see the table at various points as a 4 or a 6. Okay, it moves. On the competition and systems maintenance, when we think about individuals, countries, or groups that are at systems maintenance, these are individuals that would not like, they're risk averse. They would not like to lose. They're at the right weight. They're trying to keep what they have. Sort of like in an Eden-esque sense, this is good. Okay. The notion of management is essentially keeping what I have. I'm not going to go to that casino table. How do I not lose? And we're going to find out that's a very important notion, and the field I work in, we call these risk parameters. But the greater systems maintenance you are, the greater risk you are averse. The greater systems maintenance you are, usually the greater you are already near the front of the pack, and therefore competition behooves you somewhat. On the other end, we have competition, and if one is psychologically oriented, systems maintenance is an inner-directed point of view. If you think about it in terms of anger or anger management, if we have systems maintenance, a person cuts you off in a car, you get mad at yourself for reacting aggressively. William Short used to joke with regards to inner and outer directed systems maintenance that when a inner directed person, high systems maintenance, gets very angry at the world, he suicides. When an outer directed in competition gets angry at the world, they homicide. And in very important senses, the same stimulus leads to very, very different responses. And I don't want to make a simple discussion of it. Find out that a whole bunch of people are going around to find out whether or not they're very good. And to do so, they basically have to beat somebody. They have to figure out that they're better than somebody else in the room, which is a very important part of their being in the world. They're competitive. That locates their identity. It gives them a sense of who they are, where they are, and they're acting out in the world constantly. To be on that competitive end is to enter into a room and know what you want from it. You can either lose or win when you enter a room, but you do not enter a room with nothing in mind. Systems maintenance, a very different position. Systems maintenance, as I think you're intellectually aware, are individuals, and most of you in this room will probably feel comfortable with flexibility and systems maintenance as you're chosen. Over and over again, when I do this, when I talk to groups that are drawn together for money-making, they go to the dollar, spirituality to the community, over and over again. I mean, isn't that a natural ordination of things? And I'm going to suggest, no, it's not. It's not a freak of nature to another point of view. Moreover, in public controversy, when a serrated circle meets dollar sign, we have big explosions. Big explosions in public discourse. And I know that because I frequently am in contexts where I have not-for-profit boards with a highly profit-oriented members on the board. And they just can't understand why this can't be run like a business, which is, of course, a debate being going on right next door in the hospital. And why a communitarian context really can't be run more like a business. Okay, and you in the university might be having some of this debate or discussion, I think, as more and more of us are. Now, let me introduce you to the seats at the table. I'll start off with the seat that we could put Donald Trump in, or Jimmy Pattison, or Milton Friedman. Okay, we'll put people in them, or to which we could put privately owned firms, or which we could put a aggressive gains. This is the Buccaneer, or if you want, what I call the Money Talk story. This is the Money Talk story. Each story tells you what's important in it. Money talks. History is made by people who win because they have money. The rules are made by people with money. When you talk about the military-industrial complex, you're talking about people who have power because they have money. And this notion of money, very dirty in some other circles, as the essence of what is to be sought after, as the essence of building a morality around mammon, okay, is quite central and addressed quite openly here. The notion in public controversy for this person is control doesn't go to the person who gets the money. Control goes to people who get the money, who then must increase their control in the marketplace and increase their competition. And think about this as a series of casino tables in which the emphasis largely is you are free to play at any table you'd want. You don't have to play at Donald Trump's table. But any table you play at, you have to win. If you don't win, you go down a table. You can play at the $2 table. You can play at the $20,000 table. But you can't play at the $20,000 table with $2 in your pocket. Twice. You can play once with one broken arm after. And what's important about this is that the version of freedom is not, quote, that the powerful are all there, but everyone could exit and play at their own table. Okay, we're going to find that they have a high suggestion. The biggest sin for this person, by the way, is slavery. You could exploit as long as you let them leave. And there's an edge to that. And we're going to find out what they permit is freedom equal exit, the ability to exit. And all the notions in public controversy, if exit is permitted, this is an acceptable system. Moreover, if one wants to do what Michael does and say, what's the ethics behind this? It's just desserts. People get what they deserve. And in some senses, this is a notion of action. If we were to look at, take a photograph of the person here, it would be in motion. This wouldn't be from the head up, which is going to be here. This wouldn't be in the group hug, which is here, or in a group think. Okay? This would be in action. In action meaning doing the work of the thing. In a public controversy like the discussion about drugs in the East End, this side's going to feel very, 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 very comfortable about the economic arguments about how taxing, how getting the government to tax this is going to be useful, as they would in prostitution, how it keeps prices much more honest than the black market, etc., etc. And the notion, very important, if you want to understand this mind, remember this person at the table in the discussion is going to always say, follow the money. They're also going to say another thing that's really important for us later. They are very, very, very action-oriented, as Nike would have it. Just do it. Don't think about it. Don't plan it. Just do it. If you get it wrong, you recalibrate. These people are not at all error-phobic. You can make an error as long as you act quickly. Intelligence here is quick action. No shame, recalibrate, go again. This is the art of the cold call. Ask 100 people for $1,000 each day, and you'll get your rates. But you must have no shame and be willing to take many, many, many no's. Unlike this person, let's move. This person, by the way, the head of the Bank of Montreal, if one wants to put it in that way, avowedly Martha Piper, avowedly in the sense that she's a hybrid in my understanding as we get to understand the table setting. This is a person who sits at the top of a hierarchy. Here, by the way, the regulatory worldview, the story is built to last. Not money talks, built to last. These are built to last. These are fire departments, hospitals, universities. These, by the way, are eat sugar. They're like hummingbirds. Tremendous speed and velocity, but duration, very little. Very little. 8 to 12 years is ancient for this kind of play. They've been, it's like running 100-yard dashes over and over again. This is marathon training. No credentials. Credentials. Analytic intelligence, planning, information distribution, information efficiency. By the way, this is all about the bottom line and markets. This is all about rules and procedures. Ethics here is a duty. You follow the rules. Procedures precede you. You're born into a world which this place already existed. It had a theology before you. You are not in the act of making theology as you are here, to use your metaphor. There are sacred texts. And there are texts for changing the sacred text. There's constitutions. And notice, this is all action, this is all text and written. It is not real until it's measured and written. All the conversation here gets taken down at the table in minutes. Okay? As little as possible gets written here. Oh, this is very revisionist and very amnesiac oriented. Oh, no, there's nothing. Well, we'll discuss why you feel uncomfortable or uncomfortable with that. But I've seen it over and over again. This one is very, very much. I love you. I love you. I love you. I met somebody else. I would like to divorce and trade up. And no sense of that being a bothersome conversation, even had in a 6-month period. And if you morally try to say, well, how could you do that? They look at you like, what is the problem? I've been truthful all along. I've expressed exactly how I felt. I don't know where you're coming from. This person would have a hard time with that, especially if the first utterance was written and taken into account with witnesses and signed in a contract. And we're going to see the power of the contract here is awesome. The power of the contract, the power of the written word. The power of the signature beside the written word. Tremendous. And of course, in this one, there is a politics, but the politics of movement is and the politics of getting ahead are being called up. You're called up by people above you.
There are voices that say, number 52, come up, please.
Okay, because you have proven your worth. Here, by the way, you push yourself. Sort of the American or Israeli queue for the bus, unlike a British.
Oh, you've been there, eh? Yeah. I remember when I got to the airport in Jerusalem the first time, I was just blown away. I think I was the fourth off the plane and like the last to leave the airport. That's a true story.
Moreover, that night in the Susol, which is their version of Safeway, I got into line and this little Israeli lady came up and said she had one. I didn't speak Hebrew at the time. One, she got in front of me. I assume she meant one. I had a basket, one item. Then this other lady, she had two. I had three. So she got in, but she had two baskets. And they quickly saw that I was a rube. Oh, no, it was immediate. You know, after that, I started to understand, Because in this kind of society, by the way, or in this kind of event, if you show compassion, it'll be seen as weakness. In the conversation, if you show, in this conversation, because it really is a hesitation. They call that in poker a tell. Compassion is a tell. You're not going to move fast. You got too much baggage with you. Okay? I'm not going to go into the, and the most apt thing to think of is poker metaphors, like tells, quickness of moving, bluff. This conversation, if we go to the public controversy, if we look at globalization, this is the World Trade Organization. Before we do anything, we must, this is Canada, by the way, very strongly. Before we go up to the north or whatever, let's send the CBC, the RCMP, before we, United States, let's send the individuals with the shotguns first. So Billy the Kid goes before the law, here the law goes before Billy the Kid gets there. That's why we've not, in Canada, the notion of a frontier is very difficult. We go night. In the United States, the idea, even though it's a very settled country, of not having a frontier is almost impossible to believe. In this discussion, a frontier is an inevitable psychological phenomenon. In this discussion, the absence of a frontier is taken to be is an assumption. And the absence of a frontier occurs because this is analytically girded. I remember entering into the wilderness up north in British Columbia, and it said wilderness closed till 9 in the morning. I knew I was here. There was a little like there was a little thing across the road. So the wilderness closed. I thought it was so precious. I remember getting out and taking a picture for the book. You know, because it spoke so much, you know, and I could just see a person coming to it with this headspace and say, oh, man. How could they even think of that? Okay, and you can see this in old movies, these two, like The Misfits with Marilyn Monroe, or the battle between the farmers and the cattle breeders with putting fences on the range. I mean, very classical movie tradition, this. In British Columbia, this particular series of discussions finds its way into small business and big labor, big business, and big government. If you're at all disposed, this is your Liberals and this is your NDP working both sides of this in your provincial basis. In controversies, this basically speaks an intelligence of quickness. This speaks an intelligence of uncertainty management, planning, and being very careful, prudent. The conversation this person has is prudent. Evidence must be provided. Rules are apparent. I rest my position on positions of others. This individual, if you read the opening remarks, if he was ever to write, would cite his neighbor, this one, a 200-year-old sage. When one gets authority from the past here, one gets very little from the past. And the reason for that, of course, is that this is all about extracting rents and making the claim very much as yours. This is all very much, I am what I am because of my position in the system. I am a professor of applied ethics. And I work this, I am a professor of applied ethics, I am the president of the perimeter group. And when I present myself as different, I have different conversations with people based upon their expectations of deconstructing those two symbol sets. This is all about credentials, and I have two vita that accompany that presentation. Both of them accurate, but both of them displaying different parts of the portfolio. This is who it is I've extracted rents for. This is who I've written for. And I say this less as a problem, but more as a discussion. Let's move down to here, and then we'll have them talk to each other. This is the first flexibility story. In the field where I work in, some people call this the old economy. Some people call this a new economy. There's a lot of fuss being made about this, but we ought not to worry too much about the notion of new. There also is a moral reading of this is superior to this. I'm going to leave that aside because we're going to find out in the public controversy. Each of these worldviews, by the way, believe they're superior. Each of these worldviews believes they're superior. If you're a pure member of each of them, you actually believe that these people believe that these are slow and lead-footed. These people believe that these people only talk, and talk is cheap. And we'll see how this works. It's like scissors, stone, paper. Okay, and in the conversation, when you present from one of these points of view, you should recognize how somebody else at the table might interpret that relative to a scissors, stone, paper game. Communitarianism, or the participation pay story, is represented. By the way, the leader here leads from the front. Behind me, there are a whole bunch of people that, or things that follow, and they live in my protein wake. I bring down a large amount of protein or sustenance, and they follow. I don't ask them to follow; they follow. I imagine they're lining up for Donald Trump's apprentice show as we speak. Okay, on the hope that in his protein wake they will live. And now why or how one can convince oneself of that, that remains yours to discern. If you're not here, you'll never understand how somebody possibly could degrade themselves like that. But there are plenty. And what's interesting is their intellects are interesting too, if you get close enough to try to understand them. That's where this problem starts getting really thorny in the public area. When people do things that you consider are degrading in a social performance, we often say, can't be smart at all. And we're going to find out that's where this, what I call the small terror of the public performance, starts emerging. In communitarianism, this person leads from the top. The notion of the top here is in the hierarchy, and one is at the top because one has, quote, proven over time one's ability to systematically and analytically show intelligence. You must not be quick here. You must be prudent. You must be careful, and you must be legitimate. Legitimacy is very important here. Very important here. You cannot conceive of this in mafia terms. You can't conceive of this in mafia terms. You could actually have rich people walking around with questionable legitimacy, i.e. Conrad Black. We cannot allow that with Enron. The whole thing must be brought down. That's a kleptocracy. I don't want to discuss kleptocracy, but it's a very important notion there. Here, the leader leads from the center. The notion here is that the leader is the embodiment of the values, or if you would like to get critical, the neuroses of the group. So nuns choose different leaders than Hell's Angels because of their values. And they put in the center very different notions of Sonny Barger and Mother Teresa. But what's important about Sonny Barger and Mother Teresa is they're both at the center of a community that has a strong idea of where it stops and the world starts. What makes communitarians communitarians is they have an idea of where their community stops. So when you're Christian or when you're Jewish, you have some idea of how far from the center until that no longer holds. Which is a very different story from here. You measure from the center. And when the periphery gets too far, you're outside the community. We're no longer in Kansas. Okay, or as Bob Dylan said, something is happening here, and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? The idea of we just got too far here. We've left our people. And you can see this in space alien things when you get to the space station finally. And all of a sudden you get to the intersection where all of these groups are sitting around with alien biologies. In backwards reading. In blood that's orange. Okay, and you begin to say, well, my worldview must be superior. The communitarian communities basically have the following value set, and the value set that they have is sharing, dialogue, trust, and wherever possible, the provision of meaning. Leaders provide meaning. Leaders provide money. Leaders provide security. Leaders provide meaning here. Meaning reduces anxiety. Here, by the way, money is scarce. Here, by the way, safety is scarce. Here, by the way, time is scarce. You must do something meaningful. Who wants to be old with pee stains in your underwear in an old hotel? Find something meaningful. You must serve somebody, Jesus. You must serve somebody, Moses. You must serve somebody, Buddha. Notice the community echoes with this notion of service towards the center. And it embodies itself in notions of scholarship, if you will, if you're in the university, or embodies it itself in notions of the Dalai Lama, if that's your community. And that notion of the centrality of these values is very important because what it does is it casts, if you will, a sense of membership and belonging and of trust. The assumption made by many people of this as a superior point of view is, by the way, that if you have a community, those in it are healthy. Which can be problematic if anybody's ever been to drug communities or prison communities. To have a community is essentially to share values and this idea of a shared destiny with others. Whether or not it's healthy remains something that we'll see in various conversations. We'll see. The notion of spirituality here is also strongly embedded. And the reason for that is the notion that Martin Buber calls the other is important to you. Here the other is something you use. Here the other is people on your committee. They're politically important. Here the other is something you must love because it will return that love in turn. Here, by the way, if you're sick, you pay for the best health. Here the way you get it as a right. Here you get it because you gave it to others. You were there when they needed it. You gave succor. You were an empath. And it will be returned. So the notion of the other, very powerful here. Not so powerful here. The other is something to be used. It's a means. And certainly there are others to be. And people are rented. Oh, no, you rent people here. There's no doubt about it. others are for renting. Your job is to figure out whether you're a landlord or a renter. And if you're a renter, by the way, you want to get high payments for or low rents and good accommodations. If you're a landlord, you want the reverse. Okay. Here's the notion of the other, as I said to you earlier, but that only holds for people in your community. Where this becomes problematic is people in other communities are perhaps not nearly as thou-like. And we have to define whether the other community is the human community, animals, Gaia. Some people really get really interesting in the notion of community, taking it into soil, badgers, and mountains. Other people don't even leave their skin color. Others won't even leave their gender when talking about their community. They will extend all to their community, but we have to be very careful because the claims of various communities to how extensive the community is not a given. Okay, as a Jew working at various times in a culture that was very Aryan, I understood that I was not in that community. The notion of being disincluded from a community here can be very, very sharply and costly. And we'll find, by the way, there are no communities that I have discovered that are infinitely open. Impossible to find a center for an infinitely open community, mathematically and otherwise. So to recognize that I don't impose it just as a logical necessity, but as a experientially interesting one for you to check out in your life. The network worldview, and I must hurry. The network worldview, this is the one that my students really love, the one that's hip and fashionable now. The network worldview is the idea very strongly of the prevalence of temporary relationships and the idea that what's new and innovative is what's very important. The stories, by the way, and I'll build on the innovative one here. The Money Talk story, I think you got a good sense of. The Built The last story, I think you got a good sense of. The cooperation pay story, I think most of you are living parts of that. The portal to a new world story, let me embrace that a little bit for you. That's this one here. The network. The portal to a new world story basically is one that deifies the deus ex machina, the trapdoor, and this means that if we get together best minds in temporary communities, we will be saved from global warming and other things. What we have to do is muster intelligence, and by the way, this is all about design, applied intelligence. Scientists and designers love this. By the way, this is all about nature and the sacred. Nothing is sacred here. We could have plastic trees once the ones we have go. And we could get them at a good price and they could function very well. Thank you very much. And I'm not making fun of this, but we have to see that they say things that are inevitable except like a Zen touch and get on in design. And they see new worlds beginning in oil slicks. Okay, a much more difficult, irrepressible notion of there is no... This notion of the sacred, or this notion of the community, has a notion of disaster because it has something to protect. It has a system. It has something to protect. This is rather dislike in the sense that it has nothing to protect. Any disaster that occurs, grab the opportunity. Grab the opportunity, not in this way as a capital, but as a way of turning it into some intellectual capital. Now let me distinguish at our table the twos. Any one of these, by the way, that shares a talking point are similar. These are the diagonals. These are the really painful conversations. Let's do painful conversations and then tense conversations. Inside the community, by the way, all inside the community conversations are pleasant. Two entrepreneurs sitting at the Vancouver Club, cool. Okay. One individual coming to the Vancouver Club in order to get money in order to run a not-for-profit organization, tense. Could happen, but tense. Tense means you're on, you're performing. You're not relaxed. You're aware that you're talking to somebody who you have to watch your words. It's like talking into a dictaphone, comma, new paragraph. Okay, you have that kind of consciousness to the movement of your voice. Okay. And let's deal with this one. This is mammon. This is spirituality. This conversation, by the way, no talking point. control and competition versus systems maintenance and flexibility. This is Jimmy Pattison or Donald Trump meets Mother Teresa on the street. Okay. And if you're a playwright, this is very interesting material because it begins a sort of awkward, absurd moment. Okay, who's going to ask for what? Okay, is Jimmy Pattison going to ask for salvation? Or is Mother Teresa going to ask for money first? Because they both know what the other has, but they know that it's really impossible to embrace it easily. This conversation, the money talk story and the cooperation pay stories, really, really hinges on individualism versus the sanctity of the group. By the way, in this story, you're born alone, you die alone. That's why you're running around and trying to collect it all. You're basically very alone. Everything here is just permanent and shifting. Your job is to get as much as you can before the doors close. Touch it, feel it, run with it. I want it. But essentially, by the way, groups are not smart here. The public is not intelligent. The only thing that's smart is the individual, and the only individuals that are smart are people who have money, like you. And by the way, most groups are dumbing down. This is the type that sees a committee as something that creates the camel. Should have been done by individuals. This, by the way, sees individuals as terribly, terribly difficult. No synergy. All alone. No sense of inputs. Lack of creativity. Informationally shut in. Kind of like a shower door around your head. Not really hearing the music of the spheres which comes from other souls. This conversation is really a difficult one. Because the good world here means that you stay light and travel quick. And every time you make a score, you gotta take it away from the people who will then want to share it with you. This is like a dog eating. There is no celebration of the many. What there is when you get lots of money, what you do is you conspicuously symbolize it to others. You put it on your back. You wear it. You want to let other people know you're rich, but you don't particularly want to do what? Sharing is very low here. Later on in life, for tax reasons and other, philanthropy may start emerging. But sharing as a logical necessity. When I work with people here and I say, well, you have a lot of smarts and intelligence. Why don't you share it with your team? They say, no way. It'll lower my ability to extract rents. If I'm the high goal scorer, I don't want other people scoring a lot of goals. Even if it helps my team, it'll lower my ability to extract rents from the manager of the team. So here you get that proverbial law school cutting out the article that's necessary to read for the exam. I mean, proverbial in the sense of urban legend. Urban legend only because it's told in a school that's essentially here about behavior that's really not acceptable. So it's told as if there's a great distance to it. But it's probably happening. In this conversation, of course, what we have is a moment of righteousness meets a second of certitude. This person is certain that the world really is one of winning. And it's really now. This person is entirely certain that if you fall in love and keep love alive, all will take care of itself. And love is a moment of faith. This person, by the way, believes that's crap. That you must have faith only in yourself and maybe a couple lieutenants that you've paid for, but only a duration at which the pay is still in. And so you have this strong sense. What they share, by the way, is a belief in betrayal. This person gets betrayed by people who have the ability to basically take their money and do with it. But these people usually don't get really upset. In our notion of globalization, by the way, neither of these is overly infatuated with globalization. This one is not infatuated with this one, by the way, loves globalization. This one doesn't like globalization because they're not quite clear that they want to play at that little table yet. Okay. They like domestic markets. Jimmy Pattison doesn't know if he wants to go global. Donald Trump knows he doesn't want to go global. He doesn't want to have hotels in Kenya. New York and Los Angeles. These people don't have the confidence to play where they don't know the game. They're like gangs. They play on the turf that they know. And they got to have an experiential feel of that turf. They're really afraid of this abstract notion of the world is my oyster, which is very, very much here with intellectual property, the notion of creating swooshes and branding. This is and there's nothing wrong with this notion. It's the domestic market, capital, king. And when they do think global, they think franchise, which is a very different notion of global. In the notion of prostitution or drugs, it's quite clear what positions this is. This is a no-harm position. And you'll hear it talked over and over again in the notion of medical. And the notion of do no harm, of course, is the other is important. This is not a do no harm, it's a what? Keep costs down. If you keep costs down, you've done the best you can in the world. And so when you get places that turn to this kind of management with universities, with schools, with fire departments, you get a real important debate going on. And the real important debate is, should we run a fire department that basically keeps costs down? And you see the public, these two get very divided on this. The two other people at the table, because they're going to be the deciding discussion. This one, in the bill to last, their debate with air. By the way, this is all about permanency. This is all about the classics, standing the test of time. The bill to last, the universities are perfect instances. Here we talk often in terms of centuries, decades. We have rules. This is all about conception. What's new? This is the church now. This is the church at the time of Jesus. They would not get along particularly well if we could coach them, put them in the same place. They have to be related in an interesting way, just as we have to be related to the moment of our birth. The way in which organizations and the people I study try to relate these two are very interesting. Skunk Works, keep them at a distance. But these, by the way, want innovation but don't know how to do it. They want newness. They want new blood. But like individual who flew up too close to the sun, when these get too close to this, they lose all their innovative potential. This is all about getting it right, getting the rules right. In the conversation about drugs, this is all about making sure the legal code can withstand the onslaught, that there are precedents, that it is enforceable, that there are clear penalties and punishments, that there are clauses and loopholes, not loopholes, for dealing with this. This is about thinking about ways of getting drug substitutes. Maybe we could come up with a new class of drugs which allow people to work. Maybe we could come up with a high which is very intense, short-lived, and build it into the corporation, into the working model, build it in that people could have their breaks, much like we did with coffee. Okay. Or earlier in the 1910s with cocaine, which was in the coke at that time. The notion here, of course, is to think inside the box and think about not making errors. The notion of here is to think outside the box, and we're not sure what an error is once we're outside the box. We really are not sure what an error is here. These conversations, of course, tend to be age-specific, but I've seen the old people here at various times in some work that I did in the old people's home and the young people here. The tensions in this conversation are not between the individual and the group, but they are between the past and the future. This anchors in the past. The notion of authority is very clear. It is the great, upon the shoulders of great giants I have stood. Classic position in the bill to last. This is When I woke up yesterday, I had a dream about a different world. And I think I could make it happen. That's a very different story. It's a very different story. Okay? And these two don't get along well. When this wanders north and east, we're into a strong throw stones at this. Because this is trying to reduce uncertainty. The presence of somebody like this does what? Increases uncertainty. Jesus and the church would increase uncertainty. Might even say the Pope has it wrong. I'm not saying he would, but wouldn't that be a problem? And the idea, of course, is historians love to keep these very separate. The discovery, the running of the thing. In fact, they're, in real time, they're not that separate. What we have, as Kuhn points out, is this replaces this at various points and times and punctures it, and it's an ongoing discussion. What's new leaks into what's old in very dangerous ways that irritate the status quo. Let's spend a little time here. This is a conversation, by the way, your kids are, my kids are having. My daughter's 32, my stepdaughter. This is their conversation. This is a conversation me and my dad have. Okay. This conversation here is about what's natural versus what's synthetic. Whole Foods versus Safeway. Okay. Or Whole Foods versus synthetic vitamin store. This is about the notion of the pastoral countryside, and this is about the dome temperature-controlled city. And these are both utopias, by the way, for the young youth. These are jointly compacted, impactful utopias. If you're between the ages of 18 and 30, there is a big debate about the good. And what's the debate about is the notion of what is sacred. What's in the human mind in terms of applied or, quote, what's in that component that God has left in nature? Big debate. Big, big debate. And an important debate. Important debate in terms of the very notion of what it means to engage in the sacred. Here, the sacred is essentially not a return to, but an appreciation of something that is bigger than man. Here, there is nothing bigger than man. The design is man's design. The mall is run and operated by us. The planet is ours. Moreover, as we move here, we become more responsible. Here we have acts of God. The tsunami is an act of God. The tsunami, poor planning, failure to mobilize money and resources. And these debates are public debates. Katrina, act of God, poor design and planning of the levee, poor response time. Let's look here. Then I'll turn to questions and then I'll go home. Here, this is the conversation my dad and I would have with great frequency. My dad is a factory owner. I'm a professor. And my dad just retired a while ago and was clearly of this sort. And I remember the moment in which I taught him a bit about myself. He always used to ask me, so, you know, if you die, what are you leaving? Because he'd say, here's what I'm leaving. You know, I'm leaving it to you, I'm leaving it to your sisters. And, one day I had him, he works out of Montreal, and I had him in the library, just by chance. We had eaten in a hotel by the library, which he could afford. And, it's McGill Library, and I showed him the 8 books that I had written. And he thought about it, and he said, you mean when your kids come by, they'll be here? And I said, yeah, I think so. He says, I see your scam, it's interesting. No, that's exactly what he said. I never heard it put that way. Oh, you think I'm joking? Like, that was a big breakthrough for us. It was almost like those scenes, you know, where, you know. No, you think I'm joking? I almost, I came home and told my wife. She almost cried. Now, notion of the money talk story that debates with this one is one where in order to get things done, you have to be quick. By the way, first mover wins. You don't have to be right, you have to be quick. Here, by the way, You got to be right. Here, by the way, you play with chance. Here, you try to remove chance as much as possible. Get the probabilities. Make sure you're the house. Make sure you're the house. Here, you're the gambler. Here, you're the house. You want to work for the house. You want to get credentials and be a croupier. On salary, with bona fide, in 2029, you retire on August 1st with this much money. I work for the house. The difference between working for the house is you're not a gambler, so to speak. And with this notion that you work for the house, you have this notion that in the future, things are tied up. I get every year a thing from my pension that tells me, if I retired today, this is what I would get. I showed that to my father once. He said, that's sucker bait. You have no idea if it's even there, man. Did you ever see the money? No. Do you trust them? I don't know who they are, father. Hey, kid. And you know, I must admit, you know, it feels like Jake and the Kid, but I said, oh, yeah, I should probably look into that. Okay. And the notion, by the way, here is that you take so much on trust because I have a paper, it's signed, it's got somebody's name on it. Okay. And here, this is considered ludicrous. It really is. I'm not saying it is ludicrous. I'm trying to give you the considerations of another worldview when you bring that paper and say, I'm worth $980,000, bad. And he kind of snorts his cognac all over the place. Like something like, on paper, kid. You know, bring it to me tomorrow and we'll talk. I said, well, I can't do that. He says, well, you don't have it then. You only have what you could bring tomorrow. Okay, and this is a different game. Because you move quick here. The debate in interesting ways here. And we can look at George Bush. George Bush will not sign Kyoto. Doesn't make sense. 30 years? This time frame, when I work with people who work here, 91 days is considered far. That's a quarter. That's when the next reckoning has to be done on the bottom line. And I work with people from Monsanto, Bank of Montreal, General Motors. 91 days is far. The rest is considered dreaming. And they have people doing this strategy and planning. But it's considered sort of pie in the sky. 91 days. 3 months and a day. There's a reality zone for this player. Reality zone for this player, 12 to 15 years. Nearing retirement. Here, by the way, 30-year plans, entirely feasible. Capturable. Not only capturable, but arguably that if you don't have a 30-year plan, you're really driving out a seatbelt. And do recognize that this is very different philosophies. This built-to-last position is really one that does require those kinds of positions. Last comment. If we look at these two and these two, in this one, by the way, you'll find this discussion right here, the built-to-last versus the cooperation pay story. This is about the despiritualization and alienation of bureaucracy, as seen by the... This one looks at this as, okay, this notion of touchy-feely, talky, but you're avoiding reality. Real decisions have to be made. Things have to be excluded. There has to be something written eventually. This is too far too revisionist to keep it all in talk. Okay, so this debate is an interesting one. And by the way, most universities dither around here. By dither, they play here. Ones that are cool try to get down here. Ones that are a little uptight play up here. But it's a systems maintenance, and we are the house. The thing is to know the probabilities, to coordinate in the future. These two, this is an interesting and tough battle right now. I'm spending a lot of my time on this one. This is the fight over intellectual capital. These people put a lot of time in R&D. These people want to imitate them as soon as it's done. Scam and run, that's why I call them buccaneers. Reverse it, these people see these as smoke and mirrors. These people see these as smoke and mirrors. At least I sell something that's real. These guys are selling things in their idea stage for millions. This gal's coming around to me and has a movie written on a scrap of paper. Just a bunch of names, and tells me that I should give money. There's fortunes to be made. So these people have the audacity to see these people as snake oil salesmen. And so when you're out, and the reason for that, of course, is that a good deal of what these sell are new, and yet no prototype exists. And by the way, insofar as we understand it, one in every 16 actually turns out to even be feasible, never mind economically. That's very bad odds for these players. So their idea is to sit around, wait, and do what? Capture the rents after they're okay. And you get strange coalitions, generic drugs in South Africa regarding AIDS. These people side with these people and these people to gang up on these people, big pharma. These people say, we could get it cheaper if you let us imitate. What do you say? People, put your pressure on your government. The way in which the table works and controversy occurs is not one-on-one, but how alliances are formed. Alliances are the ways in which you get unlikely, as in politics, bedfellows. In other words, one would never suspect these three going against that. You'll also find these two frequently go against that in the conversation. As somebody in public controversy, your first thing to do is find an ally outside your worldview. If you don't, by the way, you really are going to retreat and retreat in the conversation. Talking like Michael Moore only to those people who already believe what he believes. Okay. By the way, a good deal of documentaries are made for In the Circle, talking to people who have your position. That's why they get so chatty and so open. 60 Minutes is rather interesting. It basically takes a position, if one likes 60 Minutes or Scandal, the next book I'm working on. Scandal basically tries to show you that there's a conversation going on, but it's really only a front for a real backroom conversation. That the conversation you're hearing is not the real thing. That the public is not yet privy to the machinations of the real conversation. There's a false room. There's a con. Scandals are rather intriguing because when I did my first work, I was interested in the conversation as if it was a conversation. Not that there was a possible other agenda in which what was being done here was merely for public consumption. And so I started getting interested in backroom conversations. Moreover, how backroom conversations are found out by the public. What's the role of investigative reporters? What's the role of whistleblowers? What's the role of accidents? What's the role, in revealing conversations that were not to be heard by the public, but apparently were done on the public's best interest. Watergate, Iran-Contra affair, Enron. Thank you. I'll take questions. Anybody have any questions? Yes, please.
The best thing to do is get an ally inside your world.
Yes.
In order to do that, do you have to be disingenuous when you're talking to them?
I don't think so. You have to have a shared destiny of sharing the fact that both of you have more to gain than lose vis-a-vis that individual who you're opponent to. Do you have to be disingenuous? From the point of view of all conversations outside your world, you will feel disingenuous. You do not have to lie, though. You'll be working in foreign tongues. I don't know if you speak Spanish or French, and it's a second language, but it's like that. I don't know if one wants to lie in Spanish, and if one is not new, but it will feel more awkward, the doing of it. And that awkwardness is frequently interpreted as disingenuous. It's like a first date syndrome after you've been married for a while. If you understand, you've gotten accustomed to a certain way. I don't know if it's disingenuous, though. That's a seriously communitarian question. Yes. I don't know if they get located, and in fairness, if we had time, there's a lot of hybridization, the mixing of them. These worldviews, in my opinion, are something that get located if we stay with psychology because of psychological preference. If you happen to find yourself in an organization that greatly rewards innovation, for example, I'm a tremendous introvert. Hate people, actually. And because of my work, I often face 400 or 500. And so I could do it, but it's certainly not a natural predisposition. So my sense is that we get to where we are in various ways, some of them less than permissive, less than easy for us. I don't know if that answered your question, If you want to locate yourself, my own sense is not to suggest that I want to sell the book, but I have a series of questionnaires if you're interested in this, you know. But don't. You'll understand this up here better, yeah.
Mark, one of the things that struck me from your table was the question, what happens when one worldview situates to another?
Oh, good.
And why that came to my mind.
Oh, colonialism, yeah.
Well, I was thinking that the regulatory world, the public sector organizations over the last 20 or so
years,
have been embroiled in private sector values, management styles.
Yeah, thanks. Told you I was not only on it. Okay, go ahead. How could you reasonably listen to me now, right?
I was thinking about the public sector organizations.
Yes.
The ideal type bureaucracy has in
Max Weber.
20 years embraced public sector values, alternative service delivery, the old sort of bound norms are no longer the reference there.
Okay, I'm going to just do it this way anyhow, even if... now, what you're saying is that... Hey! Proof of communitarianism, don't you think? Now, what was said here is that in my work, what I'm interested in pressures and pulls. That means no worldview is uninfluenced by others. Each worldview predominates in a certain period of time. And I could put the sheet on that goes through that, but it's a quite a complicated description. This is the time. This is our prescribed and contraindicated conditions for each of these positions. And what it means is that when the regulatory worldview goes on, there's things happening in the economic, political, and social. That means that seat at the table is not taken as seriously for certain reasons. If you understand, and they're fairly predictable. I mean, it's not like all of a sudden something happens an event happens that stigmatizes that. There actually is a certain series of prescribed and contraindicated. So, for example, when regulatory worldviews are in trouble, what do you think the dominant position is economically?
Free market.
Yeah, deficits. The notion of deficit or the notion of the public wanting to lower its taxes. Very, very strong tax claim. And one of the nice things is every time you want to lower the tax claim, the dollar sign gets a boost. Because it makes a low tax claim. And we could go through the contraindications, but largely this idea that one is being set up and one's losing the argument really is in some sense is not so much determined by the rhetors or arguers alone, but also by the conditions under which the table and the service in the room in which the table is occurring is happening.
So context matters.
In the book, Leadership in Context is, I argue, the essence of the problem. Rather than the skills solely of the rhetors or arguers, which is not a small issue, but in that paper, in my work, I argue 30% skill, 70% context as to whether or not your symbol is going to light up as an important one. In our discussions, you'll find out that right now, 9/11 kills network. Network worldview got pulverized after 9/11. It's all innovation now is biometric, security, and military. Before 9/11, if you look at it, whether you want to call it the dot-com explosion or whatever, it was very, very wild telecommunications, a lot of hope about the future, a lot. Our notion of globalization has undergone a tremendously interesting impact. You cannot speed up a trade and movement of goods all the while as the, quote, Dubai treatment recently, which was an interesting Canada. The Port of Vancouver is run by Dubai. Okay, the same company that was not allowed elsewhere. We don't have the same concerns. But what's interesting is that certain events can happen that automatically the public starts saying, I'm not too sure if I want to increase my risk at this point in time. And these happen locally in small communities and globally. this goes down, guess what happens on the horizontal axis between competition and systems maintenance? There's a movement towards systems maintenance. I'm going to lower my competitive risk. And you'll find what's interesting even in United States foreign policy right now is that United States foreign policy is becoming much more like British foreign policy, where the emphasis is no longer upon we'll send them goods through the buccaneer, but we'll actually run their governments for a while. Big departure from what made them successful and famous as a nation. If you study some of the work on America's rise to its brilliance, it was in the discovery of a new form of colonization. Don't have anything to do with it except through trade. Run the whole thing like a puppet through trade. And if you send troops, it's really only to get money to your Fortune 500. You know, as a kind of internal subsidy. The departure from this will have grave complications for the miracle that was wrought after Britain, after the British notion of colonialism came to an end. Yes, sir.
I heard you say that in your book you had questionnaires about how one decide where they fit in these pictures.
Questionnaires for people, questionnaires for organizations, and questionnaires to be filled out by government officials for country, yes.
And what that, I mean, as you were going through the analysis, I kept saying, hey, I'm a little bit of that, oh, I'm a little bit of this, oh, I'm a little bit of this. And what you then have to say somehow is, you could say a couple of things. One that you could say was, you don't really recognize what you are, and the questionnaires will show you what you are.
No, the questionnaires won't. They will hybridize you. They'll show you how much of your component is in Buccaneer, how much of it is in... I believe that most of us are hybrid. We have a...
shifting all the time.
Not all the time, but shifting, yes.
Shifting.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And so this... Like most analyses, it post-sticks rather than pre-sticks, because you don't know where you are until you've gotten...
If you talk about you...
Oh, this is why I went there, because this is why I must be reflecting this.
If you talk about you, if you talk about the diners at the table, you'll find it a very good heuristic for working out the conversations amongst people who are different from you. But you're corrected in terms of, this is not written as a New Age, find out who you are book. It is not. It is really about public controversies that emerge. In no way, shape, or form am I trying to say, read this book and you'll know yourself better. I say, read this book and you might be able to diagnose what's happening in Belarus' election better.
So what it's about is dialogue rather than reality.
No. For the communitarian, it's about dialogue. All of them think it's reality. For the regulatory, it's about debate. For the network, it's about discovery. And if for the entrepreneur, it's about getting richer.
I didn't mean to use the word dialogue. The dialogue misspeaks it.
Correct.
It's about language.
Yes. Perfect. Okay. Correct. And when it comes down to it, context is always embedded in the only thing we have, language.
Right.
Yeah. Correct. Yes. I feel very comfortable with that.
I wonder if you'd take a moment to apply this to the university.
Yes.
Seems to me one of the crises is that this discussion is not taking place.
Correct.
And
I believe that was my friend here. I think that was implied in the question here. Yes.
I hate to ask you to show this overhead again.
yeah. But... Idiot savant. Oh, did I? Thank you. Embrace PowerPoint. The last time I did that, that was a disaster. Hey, pretty good. Eh? Go ahead.
There's a massive, massive shift in the nature of the dialogue that does not take place in the university.
Yes.
Especially as I see it, the diagonal from the entrepreneurial to the communitarian.
Yeah, I would say you're being pushed along the systems maintenance towards competition, including the network, which is your intellectual patents, contracts, incubators, and other. Yes, you're being pushed. You're being pushed from the dominant left, and I believe, to locate you, I'd locate most universities around here, being pushed this in this direction. And being pushed, screaming and kicking and wherever possible, trying to duck down here, as we'll concede, we'll give you something.
Why Why do you say pushed rather than pulled?
I could be pushed or pulled. I think most of the people in this room feel pushed rather than pulled. I mean, you're correct. If I was talking to a bunch of businessmen, this would have been reversed. Language, language, language.
Does an intellectual revolution only happen in networks?
No. To the persons in every one, intellectual revolutions tend to only happen in their own worldview. So communitarian intellectual revolutions are very New Age. Spiritual awakenings, understanding, Gaia. And there's even some, quote, network ones that are allowed in there as long as they're considered friendly technologies. So Ballard, the new fuel cell, would be seen as a very communitarian invention and marketed as such. The entrepreneur, by the way, believes that all things start and end with him. The world is being created in small shops. Cheaper, quicker, and right now they're the great unifier. People in the world, poor people, could look just like rich people because of them. They could walk around with suits and in good clothes because that's what the dollar sign has done. And I'm not going to belittle that. The notion there is of an equality being created that perhaps the technology will never do. So my point being, the regulatory worldview, by the way, believes it's the center of anything that's very important about the future. Even though it's immersed in the past, we have to clearly change the laws to get to the future. And we have to work in the system to change the laws to get to the future. And we need a very kind of analytic intelligence to do that. Last questions, yes, and then we'll...
No, I'm interested in whether you're doing this from a descriptive stance or a normative claim stance. And I'm wondering, what I hear you describing is what is taking place, a descriptive stance.
That's what I was asked.
But I'm interested in what you see as the normative and value-based implications of this. What does that mean for policy or controversy in society, apart from articulating...
Yes. No, I understand. When asked about the description of a university, that's what you do. But normatively, if one wants to have conversations, controversy is not negative. Let's start off there. Okay. We cannot have the public without controversy. Moreover, the more democratic the public, the greater the controversy. We have a strong, strong distaste for controversy. Because it reveals to us that rational people don't necessarily agree with us. To find intelligent people that disagree with us is very aversive. That's what one discovers in the public over and over again. This doesn't mean all people who disagree with you are intelligent. That's not the position I'm taking. And so as a consequence, one of the first things you're going to find out, especially if we filter this through the lens of regulatory, is regulatory tends to use public conversation as a backdrop for its work, a show, while it goes about and does its, the truck. You've seen this in Canada and over and over again. We're particularly famous for it. We got the feedback. We've had the public meet. We've had open houses. We've given you ample opportunity and websites. We've consulted. Okay. So they use the public that way. The entrepreneurial view uses the public in terms of what's next. They try to use focus groups. They try to engage in intimate conversations and get you to use little cards that will give information to them on how to increase their sales to you. Oh, no, that's their notion of the public. The public is a rube. There's a sucker born every day. And one must understand that as a position has within itself a sense of indignity if you're communitarian. The notion of the public in the communitarian worldview is, of course, the notion of the people. And the people have a right to know. Notice there's a sense of entitlement. Knowledge is a right with communitarian, which is very problematic.
But isn't the normative precluded by this analysis?
How so? It works better prescriptively. But if you want to say how can one engage in public conversation or how could one facilitate it, you could have a go at it.
But only from a particular point of view. Only from one of the quadrants.
Okay?
So normative means from within a quadrant.
My position is normative is one where we have the table and we want to look at how the conversation is seen by the participants and here's the, and how the conversation might be lubricated by the individuals who are now committed.
Where does the idea of lubricating it come from? Maybe you want to throw sand in it.
Well, that's certainly one of the strategies even for lubricating. That is, after you throw sand in, what do you do? Make up. We're going to find out the role of apology in public conversation is tremendous. Restoring broken relationships that would not have been healable until they were broken. Yeah, and then I should go.
So is that the value of this corporation? Parties led to the table so that they can come to consensus or...
The value for a corporation is essentially to realize how to stack committees and other things to people it so that you could actually, if you want to keep your worldview in there, that's really easier to do with this concept than if you want to actually get at some form of controversy in order to enlarge the possible outcomes. And so the idea in many corporations, by the way, is a random walk when it comes to personnel. They throw people in to decision-making units fairly based on things like seniority, who had that position. This gives a very different way, pick, choose, match. Now, what about the morals of those doing the pick, choosing, and matching? That's always the difficulty. Because you're going to find out that once you create a heuristic that allows people to basically get a little map for people who think a little differently than them, how they use it is really... The notion of disingenuous is entirely possible. My position on that is that I have rarely... language can be genuine. I find most people's motives very unclear in this kind of work. Thank you all very much.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much, Mark, for a very, very stimulating discussion. And we'll start our forum again next fall in September. And we'll let you know by email.
Thank you, James. Thank you all for coming.